Wednesday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, world leaders pledge to protect the Earth's forests and cut methane emissions.
More than 100 world leaders representing over 85% of the planet's forests have committed to ending and reversing deforestation by 2030.
Russia increases pressure on independent media.
This is a discriminatory fascist law that divides people into correct and incorrect categories.
And climate-induced drought triggers famine in Madagascar. We'll have this story and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. World leaders are promising to protect the Earth's forests, cut methane emissions, and help South Africa wean itself off coal at the UN Climate Summit. The flurry of deals announced Tuesday are intended to avert catastrophic global warming. Britain hailed a commitment by over 100 countries to end deforestation in the coming decade as the first big achievement of the conference known as COP26. But experts noted such promises have been made and broken before. For more, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara, traveling with President Biden.
More than 100 world leaders representing over 85% of the planet's forests have committed to ending and reversing deforestation by 2030. That was the agreement done today on Tuesday in Glasgow. And then there's also this thing called the Global Methane Pact. This is something led by the Biden administration, who committed to cut methane emissions by 30% by 2030. And quite a number of countries, although not all of them, have agreed to support this pledge. So for the past 2 days, global leaders are essentially wrapping up their speeches and their initiatives. Many countries that are very vulnerable to climate change, such as Madagascar, Barbados, and Nigeria, they're all taking their time as well in terms of giving their speeches and essentially pushing the issue of wealthy industrialized countries needing to pay more, needing to pay for the damage that they have already caused to climate change, and, you know, asking for more support in terms of climate financing. That continues to be the sticking point at COP26 talks. I think one thing that I would underline also, Chinedu, is that there's still another 1.5 weeks of negotiations, and it's really tough going because at this rate, we're really not going to get to 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming. And at this rate, I think we're still perhaps at 2.5 or 2.7 degrees Celsius in terms of the global pledges that the leaders have committed. And the other thing is that, you know, it's one thing to give pledges, it's another thing to take those pledges back home and to turn them into laws, turn them into implementation and action. That is, of course, remaining to be seen.
Beyond this landmark quote-unquote agreement, have they talked about or have they put in place any mechanism for delivering on that?
There is no global climate police that goes to each country and says, you know, have you fulfilled your commitments at all? This is a global stage, and this is something that leaders have done for 26 times because this is the 26th COP. And not only that the pledges have not been fulfilled, sometimes they just languish. So, yeah, that is one of the drawbacks of these huge international summits, is that sometimes it's just more talk and less action, and very often, it's really up to individuals and corporations and just also the action taken by each government to be able to translate all of that talk into action.
There are reports that U.S. President Joe Biden has been quite busy on the sidelines of this summit. What can you tell us about that?
He has met with a couple of leaders, and one of the leaders that he met yesterday on Monday was with Indonesian President Joko Widodo. So a couple of large issues of mutual concerns came up. The first one is Myanmar. Both leaders agree to push the Myanmar junta to return to democracy. Basically, as you know, Myanmar has been in turmoil since February. The other issues are, of course, climate change as well as pandemic recovery. I think both leaders have a similar philosophical outlook that pandemic recovery needs to be inclusive and needs to be just, and not just, you know, wealthy nations, but developing nations must be included in that recovery as well. Indonesia will be the next G20 president heading to the G20 summit in 2022. So both leaders also align their vision in terms of what Indonesia wants to do. And the other big thing is that Indonesia is the largest country in Southeast Asia. It is the main key player in ASEAN, is very critical in terms of checking China's influence in the region, both militarily as well as economically. And the issue of Indo-Pacific security and freedom of navigation came up as well in the discussion.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara traveling with President Biden. She spoke with me from Glasgow. Japan's meteorological agency says typhoons have hit the island nation more than 26 times a year for the last 10 years. Japanese energy startup Challenge Energy looks to use the storm as the power source for the country. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
Battered by strong wind and rain, the Magnus vertical axis wind turbine generates power. Japanese startup Chal Energy says its turbine could offer a silver lining to storms often seen in Japan.
If we can just partially leverage the vast energy brought by typhoons, we can, in a way, consider typhoons not just as disasters, but as a source of energy.
Wind turbines typically look like giant fans with vertical blades that spin to generate power. But as the turbines become bigger, they turn into liabilities in storms with strong winds. Chal Energy's Atsushi Shimizu says the vertical axis changes how storms hit turbines and creates an opportunity to harness renewable energy.
The vertical axis makes it possible to not be affected by wind direction. By using the Magnus system instead of a propeller, the system can be controlled safely even in strong winds and also generate electricity.
Chal Energy is testing the turbine in Okinawa and southern Japan as well as in the Philippines. Meteorologists say that due to climate change, typhoons in the region are increasing in both frequency and severity. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Afghan officials say at least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded in an attack on the country's biggest military hospital on Tuesday. The attack saw two heavy blasts followed by gunmen assaulting the site in central Kabul. Rachel Judah of Reuters has more.
A Taliban security official has announced at least 25 people have been killed and over 50 wounded after two explosions and gunfire broke out at Afghanistan's biggest military hospital. The explosions took place at the entrance of the 400-bed Sardar Mohammed Daoud Khan Hospital in central Kabul on Tuesday. They were followed immediately with an assault by a group of gunmen, a Taliban spokesman said, who also added that four of the attackers were killed by Taliban security forces and a fifth was captured. A health worker who managed to escape from the scene reported hearing a large explosion followed by a couple of minutes of gunfire before a second larger blast. While there has been no immediate claim of responsibility, the official Baghdad news agency quoted witnesses saying a number of Islamic State fighters entered the hospital and clashed with security forces. The blasts add to a growing list of attacks and killings since the Taliban completed their victory over the previous Western-backed government in August. Islamic State, which has carried out a series of strikes since the Taliban's seizure of Kabul, mounted a complex attack on the hospital in 2017, killing more than 30 people. The group's attacks, coupled with a spiraling economic crisis, have caused mounting concern over the future stability of the country.
That's Rachel Judah of Reuters. Afghanistan had a vibrant media when the Taliban took over the country in August. Among the multitude of diverse channels were one run by women. That channel is now folding due to Taliban threats and censorship. But the woman who was the driving force behind it refuses to give up. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim spent time with her in Kabul. This is her story.
Zahra Nabi is wrapping up her life's work. Threats and censorship from the Taliban are forcing her to shut down her dream project, an all-female-run television station, Bano TV, in Kabul. A team of women technicians, producers, editors, reporters, and anchors ran the channel for nearly 4 years. Nabi remembers the ridicule she had to endure when she first thought of the idea in 2016. Because of religious beliefs and traditions in Afghanistan, many people think women cannot function in society without men.
They laughed. They said, how women? Women are not that much strong to do these things or to run a TV station. A TV station is very big thing that you are thinking. It's not something that just a woman decided to drive a car or these things.
Nabi proved many naysayers wrong. Within 6 months of opening its doors in 2017, thanks to her smart financial planning, the station was making money. Then came the Taliban. Even before they took over the country in August, Nabi would receive phone calls harassing her over her station's content, especially the romantic dramas.
You know, before they took the control of the capital, we were running some dramas. So they gave us a call and said, you cannot allow to run, not saying directly cannot run this drama. I said, what kind of drama is this? Who are paying you? Who are supporting you? Who did you receive fund from?
She tried to continue after the Taliban takeover, but soon found her work censored, especially on issues like women protesting for their rights.
On the protest day, I went there. They came hand to hands, they put the gun, these things, the first protest of women. So I put only some few pictures on our social media. But then they, when they saw, they suddenly gave a call and they said that you are not allowed to put these things.
When she was physically harassed outside her apartment one day and complained to the Taliban security officials, Nabi said they refused to help unless she could bring a male relative to complain on her behalf. Her staff of 50 have left the country out of fear of the Taliban. Her TV channel is not operating anymore. She has no income, but she says nothing has broken her spirit. Armed with a camera and a computer, Nabi plans to continue the fight for freedom of speech despite the risks. Even though she's forced to wrap up this place, Nabi is not giving up her dream. She's planning to pay the rent for this place for at least 6 more months out of her own pocket in the hope of opening it up again. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
Russia is increasing pressure on independent Russian media by legislating the systematic labeling of many of them as, quote, foreign agents, unquote, a category that in Russia historically associated with the idea of, quote, enemies of the state, unquote. John Speer narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
The TV channel Dozhd is one of the few Russian media that is not under the control of the Kremlin. Yet, it is increasingly difficult for its staff to work, since the authorities included them in the list of foreign agents. Dozhd fell on this dreaded list for having included in its reports material from other media previously classified as foreign agents. The station's editor, Tikhon Zaitko, says the law is a direct attack on freedom of the press.
This is a discriminatory, fascist law that divides people into correct and incorrect categories, and it's written in such a way that any person might become a foreign agent.
Media that fell into this category have to mark each of their posts with incriminating text, designating themselves as a foreign agent, something that critics say is intended to scare the public away.
All authoritarian regimes are similar in this or that way. They all crack down on dissidents. They all crack down on people who are eager to tell the truth.
As the Russian leadership presents it, Russia's laws mirrors policies historically enforced by the United States to restrict the work of Russian media.
We did not invent this law. This law was devised by the United States of America in 1930s and used since then, and especially against the Russian media.
Amid the wave of Russian pressure, the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to Dmitry Muratov, the editor-in-chief of the Russian daily Novaya Gazeta, was greeted by activists as international recognition of Russian independent journalism, say analysts.
For nearly 30 years, Muratov has been standing for the same principles of democracy, the critical and reasonable attitude to our past.
The Nobel Prize has come to recognize the importance of the independent press, not only in Russia, but internationally, at a time when speaking the truth has become increasingly difficult. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, John Speer, VOA News.
The World Food Programme reports successive years of extreme weather events have plunged thousands of people in Madagascar into what WFP officials say is the world's first climate-induced famine. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
5 years of consecutive drought compounded by sandstorms as well as cyclones and invasion of locusts and growing insecurity have created what World Food Program officials call the perfect storm. The latest UN Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, assessment of the food situation in Madagascar found 1.3 million people are suffering from acute hunger. WFP Deputy Country Director of Madagascar, Arduino Mangoni, says an estimated 30,000 people are suffering from famine.
This is basically the only and maybe the first climate change famine on Earth. If we look at the others, current food crisis, including famine-like conditions, so South Sudan, Yemen, and Ethiopia for the Tigray, they are all driven by conflict.
Mangoni says hundreds of thousands of people do not have enough food and have exhausted their coping strategies. He says many are surviving by eating cactus leaves, insects, and locusts. He says people must walk 30 to 40 kilometers to buy water, which is becoming more expensive. He says some people have sold everything, their land, their cattle, their household goods, are leaving their villages behind and migrating toward urban centers in search of help. He says about 500,000 children under age 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition. He adds an estimated 110,000 children are in a state of severe malnutrition and in need of special nutritional feeding to survive.
Whenever one enters a nutrition center, the situation is heartbreaking, with silence, no joy, kids just staring at you, and in a situation of really skin and bones.
Mangoni says he's worked in several emergencies, including Democratic Republic of Congo, the Central African Republic, and Darfur. He says he has never seen children in such a lamentable condition as these in Madagascar. In April, WFP was forced to cut food rations in half for 700,000 people because of lack of money. The agency began restoring cuts for thousands of the most vulnerable in September. Mangoni says WFP plans to further scale up food rations for many more people from December until what it hopes will be the next good harvest in April. To support this program, he says WFP urgently needs $69 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has rejected accusations French President Emmanuel Macron made about a scrapped $36 billion submarine deal. Macron recently said Morrison lied when abandoning the submarine deal before Australia joined a new security pact with the United Kingdom and the United States, known by its acronym AUKUS. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The AUKUS alliance and Australia's cancellation of a lucrative defence contract in favour of US-built nuclear submarines caught Paris off guard. France felt betrayed. In protest, France temporarily recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. Tensions remain. French President Emmanuel Macron told reporters at the meeting of the G20 grouping of industrialised nations that Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison had been deceitful, despite the two countries enjoying a close relationship.
When we have respect, we have to behave in line and consistently with this value.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
Morrison quickly denied he had lied. He insisted he had explained to Macron in June that the submarines to be supplied by French company Naval Group weren't going to meet Australia's military requirements.
I was very clear that what was going to be provided to us was not going to meet our strategic interest.
News reports in Australia have described the dispute between Australia and France as a diplomatic disaster for Canberra, and that the damage looks uncontrollable. Australian opposition Senator Penny Wong, the shadow foreign affairs minister, believes Australia has been embarrassed by the French president's allegations.
We've got a reputation as a nation for being straight shooters. That's Australia's reputation internationally. We do what we say. Mr. Morrison's failure to be upfront, his failure to, as President Macron says, tell the truth, is damaging our interests.
Mark Kenny is a professor at the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University. He says rarely are world leaders so openly criticised by their peers.
This was really quite a rare level of candour that we see, and a very abrupt denunciation of the integrity of a fellow world leader by Emmanuel Macron. And I thought that was extraordinary.
US President Joe Biden also conceded that the United States was clumsy in its negotiations for a new alliance with Britain and Australia, which cost France billions of dollars. The AUKUS pact will allow Australia to become only the seventh country to have nuclear-powered submarines. The new fleet isn't expected to be in service for decades, forcing Australia to potentially lease or buy vessels from the United States or Britain in the meantime. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
South Africans are waiting for results in local government elections that will offer an indication if support for the ruling African National Congress has rebounded after waning in recent years. Monday's municipal elections will decide the composition of councils responsible for providing essential services like water, waste management, and sanitation in Africa's most developed economy. The vote comes amid South Africa's campaign to vaccinate its people against COVID-19. Some polling stations had vaccination centers set up next to them as people were encouraged to cast their votes and get a vaccine. Top issues include electricity and housing shortages and poor sanitation. For more, I spoke with reporter Darren Taylor.
Half the results are in. South Africa's independent electoral commission says that they expect 90% of the votes to be counted by midnight. At this stage, it looks like the ANC has got around about 47% of the national votes. And the next biggest party, the Democratic Alliance, the official opposition is hovering around 24%. And now these figures are pretty disappointing for both parties. The Democratic Alliance was aiming for 30% of the national votes, and the ANC, just continues the trend of them in each election losing significant support, because for the first time ever, they are dipped below 50%. Now, what this means is that in various municipalities, in various cities around the country, it looks like the only way the ANC will be able to hold on to power in those cities is if it forms coalitions with smaller parties to keep the Democratic Alliance out. So within the next few days, that will be the big story here in South Africa, who actually gets to take over those cities and either work the ANC out, or if the ANC cuts deals with other parties for it to stay in power in those cities.
What do you attribute to the ANC's poor run in this election? Is it because of the prior cloud of corruption hanging over the party, or just that South Africans, just like so many on the continent, are yearning for change?
These were local government elections, so the focus was on service delivery of councillors in small wards, in small municipalities across the country, and in the cities themselves. And even independent municipal organizations that monitor local government performance will tell you that the worst municipalities in South Africa, the municipalities that are racked by corruption, cannot seem to deliver the most basic of services such as water, are governed by the ANC. That's a fact. Now, the Democratic Alliance has done significantly better than the ANC in the few cities where it governs across the countries and towns. And this is also reflected by these independent organizations that monitor service delivery by these parties. But what's really cut into the ANC's dominance in South Africa is a massive, massive failure by voters to actually turn up at the polls. So in many cases, what it looks like has happened is that rather than vote for someone like a party such as the Democratic Alliance, the ANC's traditional support just stayed away from the polls. They didn't bother voting for any other party. They just stayed away from the polls altogether. So there was that sort of apathy and general, nothing's going to change for us, even if we vote for the ANC. And we don't really trust the smaller party to do things any different.
What is the big takeaway from these local government elections?
The big takeaway is the continued erosion of ANC support. Like I said, these are local government elections, not national elections. However, it is, and past results will also show that the local government elections sort of set the trend for the next national and presidential elections. And the ANC can say what it likes. It can trumpet as much as it likes that the people trust us. We're still the biggest party in South Africa. But the fact remains is that it is the party that has lost the most in these elections in terms of percentages so far. Unless something dramatic happens, it is below 50% for the first time in its history.
That's reporter Darren Taylor speaking with me from Johannesburg. In other news, Facebook says it will shut down its face recognition system and delete face prints of more than 1 billion people. The unexpected announcement, delivered with little fanfare in a blog post published Tuesday, represents an abrupt about-face for the social network, which first launched use of the technology more than a decade ago. On Thursday, the company renamed itself Meta to focus on new technologies for the metaverse, unquote, a possible next iteration of the internet. The company is also embroiled in a larger public relations crisis after leaked documents from whistleblower Frances Haugen showed it had known about the harms its products caused, yet often did little to mitigate them. More than a third of Facebook's daily active users have opted in to have their faces recognized by the social network system. That's about 640 million people, but Facebook has recently begun scaling back its use of facial recognition after introducing it more than a decade ago. Kristin Martin, a professor of technology ethics at the University of Notre Dame, said the decision is a good example of trying to make product decisions that are good for the user and the company, unquote. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor. Researchers in Indonesia have found a way to fight disease-bearing mosquitoes by breeding a species of insect which carries a kind of bacteria that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside them. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Researchers in Indonesia are fighting mosquito-borne diseases with more mosquitoes, but these are carrying a secret weapon. A joint study has been releasing lab-bred mosquitoes in the city of Yogyakarta, targeting red zones for dengue fever. But these bugs carry Wolbachia, a common bacteria found in over half of insect species that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside them. It's not, however, found in Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, which often carry dengue, according to the nonprofit World Mosquito Program. Purwanti is with the group.
In principle, we are breeding the good mosquitoes. The mosquitoes carrying dengue will mate with mosquitoes carrying the Wolbachia bacteria, and we hope to produce Wolbachia mosquitoes, or the good ones.
WMP trial results showed this method reduced dengue cases by nearly 80% and hospitalizations by nearly 90%. Sri Purwangsi is a local in Yogyakarta and a research volunteer.
All three of my children have been infected with dengue and hospitalized. It's always on my mind, thinking about how to keep my village healthy.
Global dengue infections have risen rapidly in recent decades, according to the World Health Organization. About half of the world's population is now at risk, with an estimated 100 to 400 million infections reported every year.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. Florida's Everglades is the largest subtropical wilderness in the United States. VOA's Jeff Swickord introduces us to a local man who guides us through this World Heritage Site and shows off some of its main habitats.
I've been around the Everglades my entire life. My father used to drive airboats with a couple of his buddies back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. He used to take me bass fishing all the time, go out there, spot alligators. Started running tours 7 years ago, started my business 3 years ago. Definitely a blessing to be out here. It's a very, very beautiful place at the end of the day. It holds a special place in my heart. A lot of people actually think the Florida Everglades is, you know, marsh, wetland, which it is, but it's actually the world's slowest moving river. Even when Native Americans lived out here, it was also named the River of Grass because the sawgrass in the outside area dominates the majority of the area, all the marsh. There's certain sloughs out here in the Everglades that can be a little bit deeper than the prairies in the outside area, and the water only moves about 100 foot throughout the entire day. So the majority of our vegetation around us, this is all lily pads out here. And the green and red lily pads that we're sitting in right now and the yellow flowers all grow off of the same root system. The purple one to the left-hand side, that is picaroweed, also known as purple water garden lily. Sticks about a foot and a half above the water surface out here. Fruit-bearing tree right here, pond apple tree, also referred to as an alligator apple tree. Once the apples do fall off the tree, the vibration they produce do draw curiosity on alligators. Certain alligators will actually go by and eat it, see if it's something they're interested in eating. I started running airboat tours, and this felt like it was always my calling. I feel like I'm one with nature. I meet a lot of people. I can communicate with everybody on different levels, know the ins and outs of airboats, just like a white meadow that would be surrounding us out here.
International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington, wishing you a pleasant week ahead.